David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 415. I'm your time-spanning host, Steve Raker, joined as almost always by Whirlwind X Kevin and Andrew the LA Rabbit. That's right. We're still using our handles from the Marvel Noise and 11 O'Clock Comics message boards where we forged our friendships and changed podcasting history.
Oh, sorry, Steve. I actually found out I was Ramatet.
And Steve, you're spanning 15 years. Congratulations. Woo-hoo. On your Marvel Noise-dom.
Yay. Carrying it on our backs, boys. Marvel Noise is the podcast proudly sponsored by nobody, but we wouldn't exist if not for the graces of the immortal Derek Howard and his Deliberate Noise Network, where from his fortress beyond the reaches of time, he facilitates one good podcast after another. And also Indie Comic Book Noise. The show where Andrew, Kevin, Phil, and sometimes me talk up the indie comics that we're digging on. You can find, listen to, stream, and download episodes past and present over on MarvelNoise.com. There's that handy little drop-down menu on the side wall that lets you access past months and episodes. Plus, you can get new episode announcements, give us feedback, and see images and cover galleries on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Now, here on Marvel Noise, our scope is all things Marvel, with a particular fondness for and fascination with the Bronze Age. And yet, we've really loaded up on the 90s era lately, with the push to wrap up our coverage of the New Warriors and those Nova series and everything. So I pledge to you this, Marvelite, no 90s comics this episode. Although, Kevin, I think I do have to reference one later on.
Oh, no.
But so we're going to camp out squarely in our beloved Bronze Age with a Bronze Age binge of Kang Fu. Kang Fu is our segment where we cover various appearances of the time-traveling villain Kang. And boy, do we have a doozy this episode.
Oh boy, hold on to your seats. This is going to be a good one.
It's the legendary 11-part Celestial Madonna story arc from Avengers issues 128 to 135 and Giant Size Avengers 2, 3, and 4.
Yeah, I have a weird history with this. You know how readers used to get their info from like those indexes and everything? You get the little thumbnail and then you get the write-up.
Yeah.
Because you knew you were never going to like find those issues or whatever. And then as, you know, time went on, things became a little more advanced. Then it was message boards, and like someone would like do a write-up, throw in a few panels, and then people would comment, and you're like, oh guys, this is the greatest saga. But you're like, well, they're never gonna re-release this stuff. So that's how I read it, in quotes. And then the trade paperback came out in what, the early 2000s there?
Mm-hmm.
And then once that came out, I was like, oh, I gotta get this. I've heard about this. I've read about this. This is a must have.
I think it's a real, it's funny how we all complain now when they do that. So it's great they were doing it back in the 70s with the, hey, we're gonna just randomly continue the story in another comic. Good luck finding it, those of you that buy your comics at random drugstores or whatever.
Isn't that really weird that in such short a span, three giant size issues, like, yeah. What are the odds you're going to get all of those?
And they're chunked too, right? I mean, that's the structure of it is, well, it's new for its time, really.
Yeah.
In order to accomplish this over 8 months from July of 74 to February of 75, three giant-sized Avengers issues were used. So it'd be two issues, 128 and 129, then a giant-sized, then three issues, 130 to 132, then a giant-sized, and then three issues, 133 to 135, and then a giant-sized.
Yeah, and the trade paperback does not have 128. Like, I thought maybe it would include, like, the last page. Nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not considered usually part of the saga, but it is, because things start there, and that's the fallout from FF-150, and it starts the Scarlet Witch, Agatha Harkness stuff and all that, that we'll get into in a sec. All of these issues were written by surly Steve Englehart, you know, with Roy over his shoulder for some of them.
Almost cosmic Steve Englehart.
And all of the issues, as you said, Kevin, have been reprinted in trade paperback. They've been in a Marvel Masterworks by now, and
yep,
they are all on the Marvel Unlimited digital service, too. And this arc, as we've been saying, it's a seminal one in Marvel's history. It not only includes Kang for our Kang Fu bit here, but also the culmination of the Steve Englehart created Mantis's story as it was originally intended. After this, she wouldn't appear for over 10 years until Englehart was writing the new Silver Surfer title. And now she's a Guardian of the Galaxy and a movie star and all that.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
And the history of the Kree Skrull business. That's right. pretty heavy.
That's the thing. The thing I remember the most when we were going to talk about this is as soon as Marvel goes, and we're going to tell you the history of the Marvel Universe, I'm there. I'm like, I want to read that right now. Yeah. Give me.
Big doings with the Kree, the Vision, the original Human Torch, the Scarlet Witch, and more. So let's start to unpack it here. Issues 128 to 134 were all penciled by our pal Sal Buscema, with issue 128 inked by Joe Sinnott, and 129 to 134 were all inked by Joe Staton, who I've met many times. Good guy. 135 had a completely different art team, as did the giant size issues, and we'll mention them when we get to them. Also, oddly enough, Steve Englehart colored issue 128, and writer Bill Mantlow colored issues 129 and 130 and giant size number 2.
I always find it weird when classic creators like that, they're like, yeah, I only used to be a colorist. And I'm like, what?
I wonder if they just do it because they, as a favor, if they're like, yeah, I could use a little bump for the rent this month. Yeah, well, so I'm going to knock out a coloring job or two.
Englehart was writing Captain Marvel and Avengers and Captain America. So I know he had plenty on his plate, but Mantlo was just starting out and writing, you know, like Frankenstein and stuff like that, you know. At this time, the Avengers team consists of Thor, who was the chairman, because Captain America split in Englehart's other book to become the Nomad, and Iron Man, the Vision, the Swordsman, the Scarlet Witch, and Mantis. In issue 128, we get the fallout from Fantastic Four 150, where Crystal and Quicksilver got married, and Ultron 7 showed up, attacked. He was unstoppable, but gets put down by a burst of little Franklin Richards' mental powers, which then seemingly exhausted themselves and cured him of his, you know, mental power threat and everything, you know, for now.
For now.
Right. But all the way up until Burn, they would be dormant, which is quite some time. So, with the threat of Franklin's power extinguished, the witch, Agatha Harkness, has no need to continue to monitor him and leaves the Fantastic Four services to focus her attention on teaching actual witchcraft to the Scarlet Witch.
She's so pushy all the time.
Well, remember, she was still really... She was started out really creepy, not so
motherly. I know, like there'll be more modern stuff, like where she'll be like a villain or something, and I'll be like, yeah, I guess I can see that.
Agatha and Wanda hold themselves up in a locked room in Avengers Mansion for weeks while her training occurs for the bulk of these issues, and like, you know, don't be interrupting Jarvis or anything like that.
Yeah,
they cast their spells to block people out and everything, which is kind of fun. It was a neat upgrade because they needed to make a move, I feel like, with the Scarlet Witch. She's on her, like, 3-hex limit in current continuity, so it made her valuable, but I was glad to see her get promoted and to sort of move past the limit. We've been seeing that ever since her creation of the, oh, Pietro, I don't know what my hex is going to do when a fire hydrant explodes and she faints. Like, we needed to get past that.
And finally put the witch in Scarlet Witch. And then she sort of
gets a little bit of an upgrade, the Defenders, Avengers War, and then calling down some rock from the heavens.
In this first issue, 128, they're attacked by Necrodamus, who wants to steal Agatha's soul. One cool scene, though, I thought here was we get to see Agatha Harkness's cat, Ebony, turned into, like, this big, like, demon panther, which was pretty neat.
I wonder, for me, it's later on, there's a portion where Scarlet Witch reaches beneath, into her power to do something she's never done, and in it, when the guy kind of has his final scene, they do a sweeping image with his face kind of melting, and I was like, boy, I wonder if Sam Raimi, this feels very his early evil, like, I wonder if he was reading this and then a decade later, you know, he's like, that looked pretty cool. Let's put that in my little horror movie that I'm self-producing as a little thing.
In these issues, there's also this love quadrangle thing going on where the swordsman loves Mantis, but she has feelings for the Vision, who only has eyes for the Scarlet Witch, who's busy learning to be a witch.
They make the swordsman clearly unstable already.
He's really upset.
Falling apart.
Well, you know, they came to the Avengers together, Mantis and Swordsman, after they already had, like, a courtship and a relationship in Vietnam. So now all of a sudden she's sizing him up to the other Avengers and finds him wanting.
Well, so he had been surpassed by Hawkeye.
Yeah.
As far, you know, like, to have someone, oh, you know, your former little crony kind of take over and be a much bigger character was another blow to his ego, I'm sure. So it's just kind of fun. I like how that's already been established, that he's wheels are coming off the bus.
For sure. At the end of 128, a star appears over Avengers Mansion, and soon behind it, Kang the Conqueror appears, saying that the star is a beacon to him.
But he doesn't know. I always laugh if he doesn't know who the Celestial Madonna will be. Yeah. He's like, well, I'll just grab all these women and then they'll agree to be with me later on. And I'm like, what is happening, Kang?
In 129, one comment about the cover. Ron Wilson depicts the Vision shooting a blast out of his hand rather than out of the little nugget on his forehead, which is, at this time, the only place he shoots any beams out of.
I mean, I remember this one pretty well. I think this is probably one of those ones you see, like, reprinted either in, like magazines, or you go online and, like, someone's actually scanning this in, and you're just like, that is some great classic stuff there.
Well, Kang's also at the era where he's going to trot out some new weird future tech that he always has.
For sure.
Because that's what's fun about him. I mean, he always has his force field to protect him, but he always has some, what's the goofy new attack unit of the day?
Kang attacks and bests the Avengers with his macrobots. One of them drops a brick on each of the heads of Mantis, the Scarlet Witch, and Agatha in the same panel. Dunk, dunk, dunk. And kidnaps them because one of them is to become the Celestial Madonna, a chosen vessel that will give birth to the One. And Kang wants to be the One's daddy so he can rule the universe. I mean,
yeah, they can kind of reflect your powers back, so they reflect Scarlet Witch's, which I thought was good. And I always like it when Jarvis shows up to smack down the bad guy.
Yeah, it almost takes a crotch shot there.
Yeah.
Poor Jarvis. And as far as the Celestial Madonna goes, I mean, Kang knows it's not Agatha, you know, but out of respect, he takes her too, you know, just like a pity kidnapping.
She is a witch, and we don't know. Maybe she's only like 1,000 years old, and they live to be 100. I think the rules might be different for super powerful witches.
Also,
although where's her Ebony now?
You know, right? He's smart. Out of there. It also is revealed in Captain Marvel issue 39 that the Watcher is the one who caused this star to appear over Avengers Mansion to commemorate the Celestial Madonna manifesting. And he considers this one of his violations of involvement.
He just can't stop himself, can he?
No, he said it made him feel like a hero. Now, Kang goes on to say that this, the Celestial Madonna, is actually the real reason that he's so interested in this 20th century and keeps coming back, because of this. This is the time of the Celestial Madonna.
Now, I also enjoy we're fully into the small face, giant head era of Kang, which is always one of my favorite designs.
Full
it looks
bowl.
So weird, futuristic, and he's got like giant, like thigh high boots on too, and it's just I like purple, so the purple and green are good. Yeah, it's very, you would see this guy walking down the street and not you'd look twice.
You'd wonder if he came from an underwater civilization,
sitting in his invisible chair and everything.
Oh, the chair is great.
Kang captures the rest of the Avengers too. Well, the powerful ones, at least. He leaves the swordsman because he's trash. Kang takes the Vision, Thor, and Iron Man and encases them in Macrobot bodies, empowering
yes.
them.
And I was secretly hoping he was also going to take Jarvis as a further insult.
We need someone to clean up. Always be cleaning up.
Oh, I thought that would be another pity kidnapping. Well, I might as well take Jarvis, too.
It's the first robot vacuumer. Except for Rosie and the Jetsons, although that's in the future, right? Even though it's in the past. Oh, this time travel stuff is so confusing. So, oh man, the swordsman is so ticked that he didn't get taken too. He's like, no respect, I tell you, right? No respect. And Agatha uses her mental powers to contact the swordsman and lead him to their location in Egypt inside one of the Great Pyramids.
Although I think it would have been cool if instead she contacted Ebony and Ebony goes to rescue
yeah.
them.
Hey, what is it,
swordsman.
Ebony? Is somebody caught in the well? Is Timmy caught in the well? There's a fire at the old at the old Kang place.
The old pyramid.
There's a crazy set of sequences as the swordsman seeks out Kang's location. Like, the Egyptian Air Force engages the swordsman. I guess he's in like a Quinjet or whatever, and he shoots one down before he gets shot down himself. And then the soldiers are chasing him inside the pyramid, and a vampire comes out and like, kills them all, and then wanders out into the sun and gets vaporized itself. It's crazy.
I love that segment. I love the idea of like a crazy vampire. It doesn't look human at all, but just hasn't eaten for 5,000 years. Yeah. So instead of being, it's just out of its mind, nutty. And then, I don't know, that part felt good because he's going to kill the swordsman, but he hears all those other soldiers and he's like, oh man, there's a buffet there.
That guy might actually be the one from X-Men 2099. Unconfirmed.
Right? At the end of issue 129, a mummy inside the pyramid is awakened by some sunlight. The swordsman opening up, the side wall of the pyramid and let through and reflected in. And it turns out to be Ramatut, who was Kang what? Before Kang was Kang.
And he has to stop Kang, you know, because the swordsman was going to do in Kang. But Kang can't do in Kang.
Next up is Giant-Sized Avengers number 2, written by Englehart, but with art by Dave Cockrum, both pencils and inks. And right from the initial Hawkeye splash, the art just gets this big dynamic upgrade.
It's fun. It's fun seeing the Avengers. I mean, you're going to see a lot of Hawkeye in this, but it's great. I really liked it.
I thought I was going to see Cap too, because he was on the cover, but nope.
Oh, Steve, that was just to get you to drop down for the giant size. That was a lot of cabbage back in the 70s, so, you know.
So anyway, this Ramatut isn't the before Kang Tut, but rather a later Kang. An after Kang. Right? And
after Kang.
He's decided that he's going to retire back in Egypt as Ramatut, which he does for quite some time, and then eventually hatches the plan to entomb himself and awaken and thwart his past self in the future, which is our present, but really our past because it's the Bronze Age.
Yeah, this is why people go, Kang gives me a headache.
Well, I like while he's helping the Avengers, he wears like a trench coat and a hat so that he won't be discovered by Kang. Yeah, because
Kang might find out it's Kang.
Only the Shadow knows, he looks like.
Inside every Kang, there's at least a few time travelers.
Ramatut and the swordsman recruit Hawkeye to their cause. And they take on the Vision Macrobot. And it's tough, but they eventually best it. A symbiote coated arrow to the face works pretty good there.
Yeah, you got to cut off his solar power. It was very ecologically minded in the 70s.
And, oh, this makes Kang so mad that they have to delete his expletives.
I like all the Kang faces in these issues, too, where they getting pretty close on him, and he's like, ah!
For sure. Because he's, well, watching Kang, he's watching everything from these his monitors, you know?
Yeah.
Kang's master plan is to send the Avenger-powered Macrobots all over the world to preempt the end of the world with massive international conflict. So he's sending them to, you know, China and different places, Russia, and that part I liked, you know. Let's make it a, we not only are crossing all spans of time, we're crossing the whole globe. I'm a fan.
With the Vision's help, they defeat the Iron Man Macrobot, and it's a sweet move, too. The Vision doffs his cape, that means takes off your cape if you're a DC reader, and makes his cape intangible, right? Because his clothes become intangible when he does, so his cape must be able to, too. So he makes his cape intangible, and he, like, snaps it like a wet towel in the locker room through the Macrobot, and then lets go of it and lets it solidify.
Yeah, it would have been funny if it killed Iron Man. I thought he was going to use it to jam up his roller skates, and that would be how he...
You can't kill Iron Man.
Yeah, put some transistors.
Oh, come on, his heart, Steve. It's always just one forget to charge my armor away from too much.
So then the freed Iron Man helps defeat the Thor Macrobot by absorbing its lightning attack and then channeling it back at him. And then the Vision frees the damsels in distress, and the entire team takes down the Thor bot in a sweet mid-issue splash page, unless you like backgrounds.
Yeah, it's like the pinup you used to get in the annuals, Steve.
I think it's cool, but there's no background. In the climax of the first arc of this epic saga, Ramatut reveals himself to Kang, who's shocked, and they fight.
That is great.
And, well, I like how he reveals himself. Kang blasts him just to get rid of his outfit instead of killing him I think you'd want to do. He decides, no, I'm just going to shoot him to get rid of his clothes. Like, I'm not the master strategist, I guess, Steve. That's my problem.
Hey, it takes a skilled guy to be able to knock clothes off a guy.
You don't want
to
know why Kang has that. He only wants to shoot your clothes off.
It started off with a cigarette and a bullwhip. So they fight, and it's really cool how it's all depicted, because in doing so, time is briefly revealed to everyone there. So it's like this psychedelic experience that Ramatut and Kang are coming to fisticuffs.
It feels like there should be something at the back of the issue that says, okay, you and your buddy, one gets a dime, one gets a quarter, you start on the first one and like flip a coin, and it's like a board game almost or something.
Hopscotch. Kang realizes at this moment that Mantis is the one who is the Celestial Madonna. And, you know, everyone had figured it had to be the Scarlet Witch, too. And Kang threatens to kill her, the old, you know, if he can't have her, nobody will. But the swordsman leaps in front of the blast and takes the hit.
Poor guy.
Yeah, I also like how quickly Kang... What happened to Ravonna, Steve? Wasn't he all into her?
That's right.
He's like, eh, you know, she was fine for the first 1,000 years or
so. She betrayed him.
And he wants to rule the universe.
Ramatut and Kang are then transported away, lost in time, and the swordsman dies a lovable loser.
You're going to like to hit the lever on the... Why do we even have that lever on the machine thing?
Issue 130 is a transitional issue with a great Gil Kane cover that has the Avengers burying the swordsman back in the village where he and Mantis met in Vietnam.
So if you look at the characters on the cover of 130, all guys that went on to big things, right? Like the Titanium Man, Radioactive Man, Crimson Dynamo, and
that other guy,
the Slasher.
I'm not familiar
with who the Slasher is.
I'm pretty sure he ripped off Porcupine Man's gig.
I read the issue and I'm still not familiar with who the Slasher is. So Mantis's past is a mystery, right? The temple she was raised in was run by priests now known to have been Kree pacifists. And her father is Libra from the Zodiac Cartel? It's like, what's with this chick? And even Hawkeye says, what's with this chick?
Remember, our love triangle continues, so Scarlet Witch can't go play with the boys. She has to stay home and write lines with her teacher.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She's totally going to be indisposed for the bulk of the story. While they're in Vietnam, the Avengers run afoul of the Titanic Three. Never heard of them? Me neither. Maybe you've heard of these guys individually, though. The Radioactive Man, the Titanium Man, and the Crimson Dynamo. All good communists.
I thought they'd be more... Like, individually, they're a really powerful group. But I feel, I guess, when they're together, they're worse than they are apart, which happens with these villain groups.
And socialism, in general.
it's sort of like the Sinister Six thing, where it's like, hey, we can almost beat them. Now together, we must be. I mean, it's like, no, you'll just shoot at each other and fall over each other.
You know what they're going to do, Kevin? They can always switch opponents on you. And then what are you going to do?
That's true.
But the conflict with the Avengers and the Titanic 3 is actually all a misunderstanding that was encouraged by this Slasher buzzsaw dude. It was weird, though, to see Iron Man and Thor come to actual blows, right? Over whether to engage the trio who were standing on communist-controlled territory or not. But, like, they're real.
I know an Iron Man thinks to headbutt Thor.
And they're punching each other and serious. But remember, I was going to say, this is kind of topical, though, because the last combat troops only returned from Vietnam the year before this issue, in 1973, so this type of Cold War dilemma is pretty current stuff.
I was also noting, I knew the Slasher wasn't going to go anywhere, because that outfit looks like zero fun to draw.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a
every blade of glass.
Yeah, he has all these triangle, like, laid down. They're supposed to be, you know, that's how he slashes with the glass. But they look almost kind of like feathers or something like that. And it just looks like a lot of work.
There's no shorthand for it, you know? In issues 131 and 132, the Avengers stick around in Vietnam to solve the riddle of Mantis's past. And Nomad pays a visit. Because, you know, Englehart was writing Cap 2, and he was in town, and he shows up and explains how, nah, things are cool, I'm content with being Nomad, and I'm even, like perky and everything, and off I go to do my job.
So, yeah, I always wondered if they should give Nomad a cape. You know, I know Cap doesn't have one, but it could have been fun for him to play with a cape once in a while, you know?
Half cape.
Oh, even better. Everyone loves the half cape.
Kang and Ramatut are rescued from being lost in a vortex of time by a powerful being who rules Limbo, the master of time, Immortus, who actually had only appeared one time before this, a decade earlier, way back in 1964's Avengers number 10.
That blew my mind. Like, characters like that, it's like...
Right?
Such a long gap between appearances, and nowadays you think of them, like, as a staple.
Yeah, because you know what the story needed? More time travelers. We need about 7 more different versions of Kang to show up.
Kang convinces Immortus to imprison Ramatut, and then betrays Immortus and imprisons him, too. Then Kang calls forth the lumbering Legion of the Unliving.
Because yes,
the Legion of Doom was taken, I hear.
And it's so crazy who they get.
It's Frankenstein's monster,
Of course.
And Marvel was actually currently publishing the Frankenstein's Monster comic. So it's cool that they had him appear, like, in the vest here and everything, too. It's Marvel's Frankenstein's Monster for sure. The original Human Torch.
You want to get characters that are sketchy that might not work for you, but I guess you'll brainwash them anyways.
Yep. Wonder Man, who was from Avengers number 9, where he died. Midnight, a one-off character from Master of Kung Fu number 16. And that ghost pirate guy from the Silver Surfer series, from Silver Surfer 8 and 9.
That's so weird.
I remember reading those in reprints in the Fantasy Masterpieces in the late 70s, early 80s, when they, that must have been like the third Fantasy Masterpieces series, maybe. They'd reprint a Silver Surfer and a Warlock.
Pretty cool. Then the best one, the most exciting one to make this Thunderbolts adjacent, Daddy Zemo.
And full winter coat with a giant ruffle.
Yes.
I always want to put him in Tropical Operations in that outfit.
Kang teleports the Avengers to Immortus' castle fortress in Limbo, but he separates them, and then he sends his legion out hunting. First, Thor faces Frankenstein's monster, but pities him. And the Vision faces everyone and holds his own pretty good and escapes. Mantis, she doesn't really have much of a problem dealing with that Midnight guy. But Iron Man, he gets fried in a bear hug from the original Human Torch, and it kills him, Andrew. No heartbeat.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, isn't it? This was the last Iron Man, and yep. I guess it's Rhodey from here on out.
Just yeah, you thought they made a permanent change there.
I would have thought the nose would have saved him, guys.
Yeah. At least I can breathe. the heat is being released through my nasal. And the Vision ends up getting taken out by the Ghost, who phases through him. Right back at you.
Speaking of ghosts, there's another ghost haunting this series.
Not sure what's going on there yet. Giant Size Avengers number 3 features the art team of Dave Cockrum and Joe Gaella. And Joe does a pretty good job inking over Dave. The Vision, who's in a near-death coma from the ghost phasing through him, is scooped up and then protected by Frankenstein's monster, who, like, must see him as a peer.
Can I just say I like those letters, like, those numbers? Like, I remember, wasn't there another Kang appearance where they had a bunch of numbers on the cover?
Mm-hmm.
And here they go with the numbers again.
I think it was that
Hulk
issue.
Love the death issue where happens in movies too, where the guy's dying, but he has enough time for a nifty little speech before you check out. You know, you always gotta say whatever plot point or emotional resonance to have.
Frankenstein won't let anybody near the Vision's unconscious body, but the original Human Torch, who also is an android, right?
Yeah,
and then
suspicious.
It's like, say, exactly. So there's two big revelations this issue. One is, for the first time, it's revealed that Immortus is the future incarnation of Ramatut and Kang. And two, we get it revealed that, for the first time, the Vision shares the body that once was the original Human Torch.
I would also argue, Steve, three. Even if you bring back Papa Zemo from the dead, he's still kind of whiny.
I mean, he wants to run this show eventually.
So Thor fights Kang a couple of times. It's kind of fun to see them physically going at each other. And Thor fights Wonder Man. I mean, it's fun to watch Thor fight anybody, basically. Hawkeye discovers the imprisoned Ramatut and Immortus. But Zemo appears and gums him up with some adhesive X, Kevin.
Oh, yeah.
Zemo, the original Paste Pot Pete.
Yep.
Yes.
But it isn't enough. Hawkeye, even with his arms pinned, is able to get off the perfect shot.
That's a crazy maneuver.
It frees Immortus.
Well, I like how Immortus distracted Kang with a, hey, you know, I can take you back in time so your mask isn't stuck on your face anymore. And he's like, what? I'll do that. I haven't had a shower in decades. but it was just a ruse.
Yep. Wah wah. Sorry, Zemo. Immortus is able to revive Iron Man, heal the Vision, send the Legion of the Unliving back to under the rock they crawled out from, and promises to help the Vision and Mantis uncover their pasts. He's the Deus Ex Machina here.
How dare you, Steve?
In issue 133, Immortus gives a sentient synchro shaft to the Vision to guide him on his journey, and another one to Thor, Hawkeye, Iron Man, and Mantis to learn about her past. And a note, in Avengers Forever number 8, writer Kurt Busiek postulates that these synchro shafts were in fact shape-shifting space phantoms in disguise.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that makes good enough sense to me, but that's the 90s comic reference that I alluded to.
Oh, so it was good 90s. Okay. That's granted.
Not related to the main story, but what a nice opening splash of Agatha and the Scarlet Witch in one of their training sessions. 133 starts out. That's a pretty opening page.
You know, we know what Sal's lines look like, right? From seeing him inked by every possible guy over his career. I got to say, Joe Staton does a really nice job inking over Sal. I think of Joe more from his indie E-Man stuff and from his co-creating the Huntress over at DC and stuff, but and the Metal Men. He drew the Metal Men for a long time. I always liked that kooky book. He does a really nice job here.
Hey, the cat is back.
Good old Joe Staton. From here, right up through Avengers 135 and into Giant Size 4, the stories split into two narratives that continue, the origin of Mantis and the origin of the Vision. Issue 135, I should also mention, the art team is George Tuska and Frank Chiaramonte, who's, I think it really looks great, the dynamic shots of Ultron particularly look really menacing, and all these views that he takes where, like, his hand or fist is the closest, biggest thing in the panel, and the rest of it's all foreshortened away, and Tuska was a master. He doesn't get enough credit.
And I have to say, if you only have time for one issue, I think 133, the one it gives you the most bang for your buck out of all of this. Also, it's revealed that Libra broke out of jail and is in, teamed up with Mantis and everything, and he's in the crew as we go on this exciting adventure.
Plus Mantis. Plus Moondragon.
Yeah, well, I'll get to her, I promise. Also, 135,
there's so much.
135 has a cover by Jim Starlin and John Romita Sr. And I thought that the cover really stands out from all the Gil Kane stuff and the other covers, Ron Wilson stuff. I mean, that Starlin musculature, I love. You can always tell a Starlin ribcage, right? Those Starlin abs.
Do you pick 133 over 134, Andrew?
Yeah, I like that we get into the meat of the Kree Skrull for a lot of it, and I like that opening splash, and I feel it's all coming together. Like, you have a nice little mix of, look, it's a big history thing, so they have to spice in what you can, or it's going to end up reading like one of those history books that Marvel does put out, those comics that are like that. But here I think they're trying to fold in a little bit of action. I just felt it came together really well in this one. I love the old Golden Age Human Torch stuff, and I mean obviously I would suggest reading these all, but I was just like, if you just wanted to pick up one, I would say 133 is the one I enjoyed slightly more.
A lot of that Golden Age stuff, and they you know, when the Human Torch is in that capsule, I don't know how many times I've seen this, like, in various different places. You know, he's put in that capsule.
He's on fire.
They bury him. He gets out. He's all, like, wild and crazy.
Also, what kind of bad inventor are you that he just catches on fire when exposed to air? I don't even know how that is something you would build, would be a risk or whatever. But
it's highly flammable.
Like your design went really off off model at some point for that to be a regular risk.
All it takes is one spark.
I think they consulted with Dr. Nick.
And I kind of feel like 133, 4, and 5 really just merged together because of the way that they split everything up into the two narratives. And actually, I think that's the easiest way to present it to everyone is just to, well, let's talk about like the Vision's trip first, and then we'll get into Mantis. The Vision's journey goes back to 1939 and Professor Phineas Horton's creation of the Torch and subsequent attempts to bury him or put him offline because of that whole, you know, burst into flames thing, like you were saying, Kevin. And then the Vision has a realization that his recent overreactions to being entrapped were probably like reactions to the Torch having been buried for so long, for so many different times. And years, like a PTSD kind of a thing. So years later, the Mad Thinker uncovers the Torch's body with the computer brain Quasimodo, and they reanimate the Torch and use him against the FF in 1966's FF Special Number 4. And then the Torch's body was just left to rest forever in that abandoned lab until Ultron 5 came along and worked his mojo on the Torch's corpse.
My favorite part of that was showing the original Ultron design, which has never been surpassed, by the way.
We're just a rolling that, cart.
That was my favorite.
Like, Reed has all these tables, and he says, well, I'll just... He just has random places. He just puts stuff down.
Yeah. Well, Ultron actually couldn't revive the Torch on his own, so he located and abducts the Torch's creator, Professor Horton, who was living out his life as a drunk, just being a TV repairman. The Torch gets forged into the Vision, who gets given a red face as an homage to his previous identity as the Torch. But
I do like the fact that even though Horton is a drunk old rummy, he still works out a lot and is really, really in good shape for a guy that drinks himself to sleep every night.
But Horton betrays Ultron and doesn't erase the Torch's memory, so when he's animated, he turns on Ultron. Ultron kills Horton, bests the Vision, then uses the Thinker's device with the late Wonder Man's brain patterns on them and replaces the Torches with those. Transformation complete.
That's a lot of work.
Then he gets sent against the Avengers, later joining them. There you go. Now, Mantis's trip, though, is a way weirder one.
Oh, it is so good.
It starts on the Kree homeworld Hala. Hala! And the first year of their recorded history, there were two races on Hala. The barbaric, warlike humanoid Kree and the peaceful plant people, the Kotati.
Yes, this is where I get all my ideas. Like, you know, when we had that whole invasion?
Yeah.
By the Kotati, and I was just like, I know I haven't read every one of their stories, but how they're presented here is like how I always picture them.
I like all these crazy plant, like the ones that Phoenix killed and the one that Iron Fist has to deal with and everything.
Yeah.
Marvel always has some nutty plant people out there in space.
So the then peaceful Skrulls, yeah, you heard me right, the then peaceful Skrulls make first contact with Hala and propose a challenge. A group of each of these inhabitants will be placed on a remote, desolate planetoid, and after a year's time, their progress will be judged by the Skrulls, and that race will be the envoy to the still, at this time, benevolent Skrull Empire. So the Kree get placed on Earth's moon with some Skrull resources, and in a year's time, they build a giant compound, this near-city fortress. That's right, Marvelite. It's the origin of the blue area of the moon that becomes the Watcher's Citadel.
Yeah, I'm so impressed with the Kree. I mean, they're it's not like they're cavemen, but it's like here's some technology that you're not familiar with, and it's like their mind expands and they're like, "Hey, we'll build this crazy futuristic city." And you don't see all their cities, where they come from. But it seems like it's nothing like this city.
Yeah, they were pretty much caveman level, it seemed like, when they found stuff. For 1 year to jump ahead, it is impressive. But he goes on about how they work till they drop, and they really are hardworking. But the Skrulls aren't that nice, Steve, because they're only like, we can only take one. I mean, how do they think that was going to work out? Clearly, they want one of them to conquer the other one is the less than, you don't got to be Machiavelli to come to that conclusion.
Also, I should mention that the Kree here are erroneously drawn with pink skin instead of the blue skin, because it isn't until much later in their history that the pale skin Kree offshoot develops. So that was just they've tried to retcon this a couple of different ways in the past, but when it comes right down to it, it was just an accident that these guys aren't all drawn blue, colored blue.
Yeah, it just kind of reminds me of a Star Trek thing where in the original series, how they, like, the Klingons don't have the bumps, and then they're like, how are we going to get out of this one? And then they have all these different explanations and stuff, and you're like, yeah, it was just a different time.
So while the Kree used their warlike nature to become, industrial, and turned it into this industrial pursuit, the Kotati instead make a lush garden that's fertile with life from their desolate landscape. And much to the chagrin of the Kree, the Kotati are deemed the winners. So the warlike Kree slaughter the Kotati. And when the Skrulls arrive and are horrified, the Kree slaughter them too.
Steve, wouldn't you say with the Kotati, it's not really slaughter so much as harvest?
And so this begins both the warrior nature of the Skrulls from this point onward, but it's also the origin of the Kree-Skrull conflict.
Yeah. Wow.
There's a lot coming out of this storyline, Kevin.
I know, they're like millennia long war, the blue area of the moon, and the Kree like advance like pretty fast.
So with the Kree, the only remaining life form and culture on Hala, they develop their warrior race and culture. And the peaceful Kree among the Kree are ostracized into like a religious sect, almost like a cult, that gets persecuted and exiled like three different times. And I mean, we're only touching on the history that's presented here. The peaceful priests of Hala eventually find some surviving but immobile Kotati who have really transcendent mental powers, and they form an alliance together.
See, I don't know if that was the best strategy for the Kotati, though. They're like, hey, we can't move anymore because people came after us. And I'm like, maybe it would have been better for you to run faster or, like, fly or something.
Yeah, but they're like a big hive mind, super genius. They're past all that wanting to move around, and they can figure out how to trick dumb species into taking care of them.
They couldn't move fast even when they were at their fastest, so I don't think they were giving up much speed by channeling all of their energy into their mental prowess. The priests escape to various locations in the galaxy, each bringing a Kotati survivor to plant in their new homes.
That's one of the biggest things I remember. I'm like, hey, remember that time they brought potted plants around with them?
That's just what the Kree do. Happening? So one such group ends up on Earth in Vietnam and formed their temple and planted their Kotati and all that. And Mantis recognizes this garden where the Kotati was planted as the site where they just buried the deceased swordsman.
But I feel like there's massive amounts of time missing in this story, and we just leap from one thing to the other. Because I'm thinking of the Kree history. And I'm like, they're advancing. And then at some point we leap to the Supreme Intelligence, and I'm like, wait a second. Like, there's a lot to go through right there. Like,
yeah, when they stop advancing, right?
Oh, this is not the history of the Kree.
I mean,
this
it isn't,
the history
but
of
my brain is like, that's a whole other issue I want to see.
All right, well, we got plenty of Marvel Noise episodes ahead of us to explore all that, Kevin.
All right.
So, weirdly enough now, we've been seeing glimpses of a ghost swordsman that Kevin alluded to before, who glows green in color. So you're getting the picture, right? They buried him there. It's next to the tree. We got a Green Swordsman ghost. The Green Ghost Swordsman and Libra, Mantis's father, are there and, you know, reveal themselves to the group. And Moondragon shows up, who'd been tracking the Avengers. I mean, what the heckle and Jekyll is going on here, right? Moondragon's trip is that Thanos killed her family on Earth. So Thanos' father, Mentor, took her as an orphan and raised her on Titan, Saturn's moon. And she's a powerful telepath and martial arts expert. A scenario that basically mimics what was known to be Mantis' origin from Avengers 123 that had the cryptic title An Origin for Mantis, not The Origin of Mantis.
I do like the whole air and a spare. Like, we're going to try to... It's the ultimate nature versus nurture. Like, we're going to have one raised here and one raised on Earth and see who ends up being the celestial Madonna parent.
Yeah.
But see, how about that? I really like the splash of Thanos in 135.
Splash. But it's also kind of like a beauty pageant where, you know, if the celestial Madonna Mantis somehow was unable to execute the duties and responsibilities of the title, there would need to be an understudy, right? Like a runner-up to take her place, and that's Moondragon. Which is crazy, right? But it all fits with Starlin's origin for her. So Mantis's mother was killed, and her father was blinded but survived and brought her to the temple where she was raised, while her dad became one of the Zodiac Cartel. And they each get raised by priests who descended from the peaceful exiled priests of Hala, and they each learn to commune with the Kotati and become martial arts experts, never knowing of the other. That's pretty cool. Well, in the finale, which is Giant Size Avengers number 4 in February 1975, under a Gil Kane, John Romita cover, the art here is by Don Heck and Tartaglioni, the Scarlet Witch and Agatha Harkness and the Gaia Earth Maiden spirit have been abducted by Umar and a convalescing Dormammu. And the Vision's wand brings him to their location as his last stop, and he succeeds in helping to free them. And then the Scarlet Witch puts out Dormammu's, like, recovery coals, and he's forced to release them.
Yeah, what a crazy mix-up of, like, it's fun seeing Dormammu, even though he's severely handicapped in this one. I don't really mind that he's handicapped because it explains why he's able to be yet again bested by a puny human. But
yeah.
And so
the I feel like the art is a bit of a, because they have to jam out so many pages. Like, we had that really strong 3 issues through the Avengers. It's not really a knock on the team. I imagine they were just under the gun.
You know what though? And after
had to get all these pages out,
after having the bunch of issues of Buscema and Staten, and then having the change-up issue of Tuska and really liking it, then switching to yet another artist of Heck. And I do like Heck's art in a lot of places, but it seemed like a downgrade here.
Yeah. I just imagined it was, hey, Dandy Don, can you do 1,000 pages in 3 days? Sure. Yeah. I need the money. So,
the Vision, he feels like a new man, complete now, right? Because he knows of his past and everything. So he asks Wanda to marry him, and she says yes. Meanwhile, the Avengers discover that Kang attacked the, what did we call them? The Titanium 3, the Terrific 3, the Terrible 3, whatever they were. Terrific 3?
The Crimson 3? The Dynamo 3? Dynamic Duo? Oh, wait.
The Avengers split up, and each of them capture a Kang, which is... Each of those are fun sequences. But it was all a distraction, because the real Kang kidnaps Mantis. After all this time, he's won, and he splits right off the scene immediately. Later, suckers. Pew! He's gone. But Immortus appears, and we know Immortus is the deus ex machina of this story, right? He appears with the real Mantis. He swapped her for a shape-shifting space phantom. So who's the sucker now?
I like to think, though, that they come to be buddies and they get married off page sometime later.
The space
they both commiserate about how they got
Ollie,
tricked.
I don't love him. So the Celestial Madonna is free now. And it's like, well, what's her deal? What's her purpose, right? And it's to marry that Kotati tree there that's planted in the garden. And she says yes. So
well, she's sort of marrying the ghost version of Swordsman, if that makes anybody feel better.
Yeah, I think that's the exact purpose of that, is to make her feel better. So the 11-part Celestial Madonna saga ends in Giant Size Avengers number 4 with a double wedding. Vision and the Scarlet Witch, and Mantis and the Green Ghost Swordsman, who then their spirits fly into the heavens at the end.
And like most weddings I've been to, Steve, everyone wears their work clothes. Yeah. You know.
Well, in a superhero wedding, you never know who's going to attack. They just had that Quicksilver crystal one go sideways, so you better weapon up.
Well, usually they give them like a veil or a tie, or, you know, spruce up your superhero duds a little bit.
I think they kept trying to pin the carnation on the swordsman, and it just kept going right through. So a lot came out of this, right? But from the Kree-Skrull history and the Watcher's Citadel and Mantis's origin and the death of the swordsman and Agatha Harkness teaching Wanda, the Vision learning he's the torch, Immortus revealed to be Kang, the wedding of the Vision and Scarlet Witch. I mean, so much history came out of this series.
Very classic.
Now,
yeah, I really like I said, that last run Avengers issues are really pretty cool. They really move. But because in the beginning I was like, it's fine. I like it. I like the vampire. It's good. Then it just picks up when you get to that history stuff.
There are definitely avenues of further exploration that, because this is such a seminal storyline, there are very many sequels that touch upon things from this series that we can explore down the line, right up to that big giant empire saga event that happened just a few years ago. This was Mantis's last appearance in the Marvel Universe for over a decade. She didn't appear again until Silver Surfer number 3 in 1987, that Steve Englehart also wrote. But, oddly enough, a woman calling herself Willow, with Mantis's distinct speech pattern, and later her trademark green skin, appears in Justice League of America number 142, in 1977, which was also written by Steve Englehart, and the official handbook of the Marvel Universe lists Willow as one of Mantis's aliases.
What?
How about that, Kevin?
That's wild.
And one for you, Andrew. In Steve Englehart's Scorpio Rose number 2 from Eclipse Comics in 1983, the one that was first drawn by Marshall Rogers and then Todd McFarlane, Mantis appears there too.
I did love that coyote. For me, it was a coyote book. But
yeah, well, yeah. I think Scorpio Rose was a backup in Coyote, yeah, and then was given out. Yeah.
But I was more of a coyote man, sad to say. I foolishly didn't follow the McFarlane train.
But isn't that funny that it Mantis was used in these other places, and now she's a movie star?
Where's her ghost tree husband, Steve, huh?
Yeah. He's left behind, the lovable loser that he is.
Well, he couldn't go on the honeymoon, I guess.
There's more about that. All right, so that's the Celestial Madonna saga. It was worth the trip. I have never read it from beginning to end, despite having read so many references to it and some individual issues. Some of these issues were among my first comics ever bought off the shelves, but obviously they made no sense to me at the time as a 5-year-old. But it's always fun to see Thor fighting somebody, right? All right.
By my hammer.
Thanks for taking this ride with me, guys. I know I've been mentioning this one for a while. Next episode, we'll get some recent reads in and some Daredevil comics. Until Libra reveals that justice isn't blind, it's merely cross-eyed. Make mine mark.